WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol Probiotic Drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latte from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and as the Middle East undergoes an epical power shift in this year of the Arab Spring, and with Palestinian statehood on the UN docket this week, we will spend a little time now recalling one of the last big changes in the balance of power in the region during the oil price shocks of the 1970s. And if you lived through them, you know they were shocks indeed. And we'll ask what can be learned from that history by the United States, the Arab people, the Iranian people, Israel, and more today. Andrew Scott Cooper has worked for the United Nations and Human Rights Watch, among other things. He is now a doctoral candidate in American history, and his new book is called The Oil Kings, How the U.S., Iran, and Saudi Arabia Changed the Balance of Power in the Middle East. Andrew, welcome to WNYC.
Thank you for having me.
So Richard Nixon is president. Henry Kissinger is Secretary of State. The Shah of Iran is in power, friendly to the U.S. in the Cold War. And you tell us Nixon is encouraging the Shah to raise our oil prices?
Yes. Nixon wanted to help the Shah modernize Iran. And in order to do that, the Shah needed to raise more oil revenues. And at that time, there was an oil consortium composed of U.S. and European oil companies in Iran. The Shah wanted to take control of the consortium and wanted to then gin prices up. But at that time in 1970, it didn't seem as though raising the price of oil would cause the sort of massive dislocations we saw by 1973.
This was also so Iran could buy American-made weapons, wasn't it?
Yes. Yeah. And the trade-off here is higher oil prices means Iran can fulfill its obligations as our gendarme in the Persian Gulf to safeguard the shipping lanes and the oil fields.
But give a guy a gallon, he'll take an oil field. This created an economic monster?
Yeah, I mean, this is where the superpower creates a super client. And I think it's a phenomenon you see today in countries like Pakistan, where if you surrender too much strategic leverage over an ally, remember, the ally has their own national self-interest. And the Shah was at heart a Persian nationalist. He was very much anti-communist, ally of the U.S., but he had his own national interest.
So did the Shah stop caring if he hurt his patrons in the U.S.?
I think that he failed to recognize the damage that was being done not only to the U.S. economy but also to the international financial system. And by 1974, you're seeing real tension building up in the financial sectors. Banks were having problems. In fact, there were bank failures in 1974 in Germany. And representatives from leading industrialized countries met to discuss the terms of a financial bailout if, in fact, they had a debt default crisis. Now, this was 1974.
But we don't recall oil prices really going through the roof until the Arab-Israeli War of 1973, right?
Yeah.
Then there was an Arab oil embargo, and they started to raise prices on the United States.
Yes, oil prices quadrupled in 1973. Now, they went from a couple of dollars up to $11.65, which some of your listeners may think, well, you know, what was the problem?
But that was per barrel.
Per barrel, yes. But when you have that fourfold increase in a short time period, consumer economies did not have time to adjust. They did not have time to change their budget estimates and spending patterns.
And the price of gasoline went from, I think it was about 40 cents a gallon to about $1.60
yes,
a gallon,
yes.
Which for people, I guess, in that time with the cost of living, you know, in that day's dollars, that was quite a shock.
It was, and it led to double-digit inflation.
And what did the Shah of Iran have to do with this?
Well, he cut a deal with he actually told Kissinger before he doubled the price in December 73, this was the last big increase for the year, that he felt that he was justified in seeking a big increase. The trade-off here was that the Shah had just helped the Nixon administration break the oil embargo. Unbeknownst to most people today, King Faisal buckled under U.S. Pressure in as early as November 73. There was a military contingency plan in place to send U.S. Marines into Abu Dhabi. The Shah helped fuel a U.S. carrier task force that was off the Gulf of Oman, and King Faisal agreed to provide fuel to the U.S. military. He backed down, essentially.
So OPEC, including the Shah, sort of goes crazy and starts gouging us, and the United States turns to Saudi Arabia?
Yes. There's the fascinating division within the Nixon and Ford administrations over exactly how to deal with the Shah. The Shah is our ally. He's the Cold War warrior. Former Secretary of Defense Schlesinger described him to me as our gladiator. And on the geopolitics, he was quite good. But on the economics, this was doing real damage to the U.S. economy. That had a geopolitical impact, too, because it was destabilizing southern-tier European countries such as Greece, Portugal, Spain, Italy.
Why do those names sound familiar?
We are seeing 35 years ago this month, the U.S. and the Saudis concluded a plan to break OPEC from the inside. The plan was to dislodge Iranian dominance of the cartel. The Shah wanted higher oil prices. The Saudis pledged moderate price increases. In return, there were some deals.
But when you say Greece, Spain, Portugal, Italy, the same countries that are experiencing the debt crisis today in Europe with worldwide ramifications, there were some parallels at the time, right?
Absolutely. Those countries, when oil prices went through the roof in 73, 74, they suddenly found that they needed more money. They had spending commitments. To do that, they took big loans from Wall Street banks, including Bank of America, Citi, Chase, and Morgan. By 1976, the Treasury Secretary, Bill Simon, is telling the president, essentially saying to the president and the National Security Council, there's a problem here because if there's a single default somewhere along the line, one of our banks could go under.
Andrew Scott Cooper, my guest on WNYC. He's written a book called The Oil Kings, How the U.S., Iran, and Saudi Arabia Changed the Balance of Power in the Middle East. This is history from the 70s and how it sets up some of our situation today. So to continue with the plot, the Saudis flood the market, bringing down the price of oil. That worked as the U.S. hoped?
Yes. Well, it worked on one side of the ledger. The problem they had was that what they were trying to do was break OPEC without hurting Iran's economy. Remember, the Shah wanted to raise oil prices because he was having spending problems too. He'd overspent his development plan. So he was banking on those new oil revenues in 1977 to help him out of his own financial hole. When those oil revenues evaporated, suddenly he is left with multi-billion dollar gap in his budget. So that then caused a real problem for the Iranian government and caused the Iranian government to institute an austerity plan that had political problems.
So bringing down prices also moves Iran in the direction of bringing down the Shah and ushering in the Islamic Revolution?
Yes, there is definitely an economic component here to the outbreak of the revolution because the austerity program put many people out of work. Many of them were young men, recently moved into Tehran from the outlying provinces. They were often uneducated. They worked in building construction. They were more conservative and religious in their outlook. Suddenly you have people unemployed standing on the streets of Tehran and South Tehran, and these people are the kindling for the revolution to come.
So by this time, Nixon is out of power.
Yes.
Ford is president for 10 minutes and then Jimmy Carter. Where's Henry Kissinger?
A busy 10 minutes, I should add, for
absolutely.
Jerry Ford.
Absolutely. Those 2 years or so from 74 yes. to 76. Where's Henry Kissinger in all of this?
Well, Kissinger is the bag man. Kissinger is the one who is sealing the deals between Nixon and the Shah. But when Nixon leaves office, you have a president who is unfamiliar with the backroom negotiating, and Kissinger takes it upon himself to, in some ways, become policymaker, and he dominates discussion and control of U.S.-Iran relations. It's very personalized at this point. When we talk about U.S.-Iran relations during this period, we're talking about President-Shah relations, and under Ford, it was really Kissinger-Shah relations.
Much of this, I think it's safe to say, is well-known history. So what did you find in your research that you think are the biggest new revelations?
I was very interested to learn that U.S. officials as early as 1974 worried that the Shah's regime was not as sound, as strong as they were saying in public, that was not as strong as it appeared to be.
As early as 1974,
yes.
And the revolution was in 79.
Yes, that's right. And as early as the summer of 1975, there are so many Americans living in Iran that Kissinger is told we are going to have a major incident involving American nationals inside Iran. There's a rise of anti-American sentiment. Our people there, and we're talking about 20, 30,000 Americans in Iran at that time, are vulnerable.
So you're saying that years before the infamous siege of the U.S. Embassy in Tehran,
yes.
with all those American hostages held for more than 400 days, that brought down President Carter
yes.
and launched Nightline, by the way.
Yes.
That was predicted and foreseen as a possible outcome of the Islamic Revolution, but what? Wasn't prevented when it could have been?
There were red flags going up at this time, all the way from 1974 on to 1978, where the revolution breaks out. Those red flags were ignored, I think it's safe to say, by Secretary Kissinger. However, they were not ignored by everyone. In September of 75, Secretary of Defense Schlesinger went to President Ford, and there's this sort of remarkable moment where he says to the president, "We have a problem in Iran. And I think it's time we have a reassessment of our policy. We have too many Americans pouring into the country, and the Shah's prospects are looking a little uncertain." Now, this is 1975.
Andrew Scott Cooper, my guest on WNYC. His new book is called The Oil Kings, How the U.S., Iran, and Saudi Arabia Changed the Balance of Power in the Middle East. What new insights did you develop into Kissinger and the way he ran U.S. foreign policy?
Well, that is a good question. There is a Machiavellian instinct at work there.
Not a new revelation.
Not a new revelation. I think that Kissinger in his memoirs has liked to portray himself as the Shah's confidant, as someone who was close to the Shah. Certainly he was negotiating deals with the Shah, but we now know that the Shah was on to Kissinger very early in the game. He did not have it was not a mutual admiration society here. The Shah understood he was working with someone who was wily, but the fact is that the Shah out-negotiated Nixon and Kissinger and all the other U.S. officials for years, over a period of years.
So we know Kissinger is Machiavellian. Was he smart, at least, and got what he wanted?
He would get short-term advantages, but Kissinger was not smart on the question of economics. And this is a pivotal moment in U.S. history because this is where you see the emergence of economic foreign policy in addition to foreign policy.
We've been talking mostly about the power players, the Shah, the Saudi king, the president and secretary of state of the United States. Where do the Arab or Iranian people come in? Are they just bystanders to all this?
Well, at this moment in Iran, the Iranian middle class is from after the oil money flooded the country, they were doing quite well, and you see an upright increase in living standards. But that didn't last very long because almost immediately Western consumer demand for Iranian oil fell. That meant that the Shah was left with hundreds of millions of barrels of oil that no one wanted to buy. And you saw too much oil money flooding into a country that lacked the infrastructure to absorb it. This then led to a recession in Iran in 1975-76 and collapsed confidence. I would argue collapsed confidence in the Shah's regime.
What about Israel? Is it a player in the story in any way?
Yes. I mean, hard to believe today, but Israel and Iran were very close.
Under the Shah.
Under the Shah. Iran was a major supplier of Israeli oil, and they were engaged in this operation in Iraq to get Iraqi Kurds mobilized against Saddam Hussein. You know, Saddam Hussein is a bit of a figure in the book as well, on the distance, because they were hoping to tie down Saddam Hussein's military on the eastern frontier, and that would relieve pressure on the Israelis who were to his west.
And that actually happened after the Islamic Revolution. Once the Ayatollah was in charge, Iraq and Iran fought each other in a horribly brutal, deadly war, million casualties, people estimate, throughout the 1980s.
Yes, I mean, one of the Shah's great accomplishments was to sign a peace accord with Saddam Hussein in Algiers in March of 1975. Of course, it had a blowback. One of the aspects of that peace accord was that Saddam Hussein agreed to allow Shia pilgrims to come into Iraq from Iran to visit Shia holy places, many of them made straight for the Ayatollah Khomeini, who was living in Najaf at the time.
What lessons from this history apply to the Arab Spring or the global economic problems today? Anything from which you could draw a straight line?
I think they're connected. I think that when the history of this time, the our times are written, yes, those regimes in the Middle East were mottled and they were sclerotic and they were probably going to fall anyway. But I have to wonder whether this financial crisis was the last straw, because the U.S. is unable to – the U.S. is distracted at home with its own financial and economic problems and is clearly losing power in the Middle East. But when people rose up in Egypt and Tunisia, I think that there was a basic economic self-interest at work there.
You have one favorite story from your book that I didn't ask you about?
Well, there, I'd say the Shah's cancer diagnosis is an interesting one. I found out that the ambassador to Iran at the time, Richard Helms, the former CIA director, was tipped off in 1975 that French doctors were secretly coming into Iran to treat the Shah for an undisclosed ailment. He then confronted the Shah, "Your Majesty, I hear that there are rumors you have cancer." The Shah says to him, "Don't be silly. This is typical gossip. Yes, the doctors are treating me, but there's nothing serious about it." Well, we now know that the Shah had been diagnosed with incurable lymphoma. Had Kissinger and Helms taken that information one step further, placed a tail on the French doctors who were flying back and forth between Tehran and Paris all the time, the doctors on every Monday morning drove straight from the airport to their cancer institute, they would have known the doctors were cancer specialists.
Andrew Scott Cooper has written a book called The Oil Kings, How the U.S., Iran, and Saudi Arabia Changed the Balance of Power in the Middle East. Fascinating history. It sets up our conditions today. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, Ode to the Freestanding New York City Parking Meter. The last ones disappear in Manhattan today. Stay tuned.